Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive, but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody. Pascal Finette here. We are back with another episode of Disrupt Disruption. And today, I'm particularly excited to have with me Professor David Beattie. David is the chair of the Sharon and David Johnson Center for Governance Innovation and the professor of strategy at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. Previously, he was the president of one of North America's largest food manufacturing companies. In his long career, he had 39 different board of director seats in Canada, America, Mexico, Australia, and England, and has been chairman of 9 public companies and so much more. We will link to David's bio in the show notes, so you can look him up. Highly recommended. David, I'm excited to have you on this podcast. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Pascal.
David, I'd be curious, with your experience and particularly your work with boards of large corporations, privately held, publicly traded companies, conceptually, how do you even think about disruption? What does it mean for you? How do you talk to boards about it? What are the gotchas?
Yeah, that's a very deep question, Pascal. I wish there was a stroke of light from God and say there's 3 things you have to do to get it right, but they're not. Everything is contextual, as you know, in large, complex corporations run by human beings. And so there's no immediate answer that I can give you. I always start with Anna Karenina. Every happy family is happy in its own way. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. So if you know one family business, you know literally one family business. If you're familiar with a board of directors, you know that board of directors. So having a board cope with disruption is a huge challenge for them. They're basically good at policing functions, oversight, making sure management's not stealing too much, complying with all the agencies, boards, and commissions who oversight you, either the SEC or industrially or somehow. And that policing function is generally well done, although there's some wonderful examples like Wells Fargo, where apparently nobody on the bank board knew that for 10 years the company was systematically stealing from its customers, even though there were 1,300 former employees suing the company in a class action lawsuit because they had been wrongfully dismissed. The only way they could meet their targets was to fabricate accounts, and they refused to do it, so they were fired. 1,300 of them in a class action lawsuit, and apparently not one director was aware of this. So it shows they're very kind of introspective. They're often captured by their CEO. So I think Mr. Stump, there would have been no question as chair and CEO of Wells Fargo Bank that the directors he put around that table were ones that he felt he could rely on to trust in him. But on a board, you eat what you're fed. So if Mr. Stump is feeding you materials, you don't happen to ask the question. Or if you ask the question, what about that lawsuit, John? Oh, well, that's just, David, we get them every day. Oh, okay, fine. So it's very difficult to move them beyond that policing function. And as I say, even that's often not well done. Into what I'd call a value creation or value protection or value evolution role. This is basically how I see boards. They have an A function and a B. A is to make sure that management is not stealing too much, and B is to try to add value. And of great interest to that perspective, McKinsey's book, a year last January, I think it was called The 76 Best CEOs in the Universe, something like that, where they interviewed the people they deemed to be the very best executives alive and asked them what their cognitive biases were in various functions and duties. And when it came to the board, the cognitive bias that really worked for these successful CEOs was help the board help me do my job. In other words, you think about them as a group of really experienced executives, like having a McKinsey advisory roundtable. And so your job as CEO is to help them help you. So to begin with, dealing with disruption, A, there's got to be an openness that the CEO is not going to be a John Stumpf and shut you down at every opportunity just to get through the board meeting, but that the CEO is actively trying to engage you as a director in the challenges the company faces. And if that doesn't happen, nothing will happen, because basically boards are made up of part-timers who have experience but not expertise in the particular business they're overseeing generally, and who do a lot of other stuff. So they're very busy. One of the private equity guys from Chicago wrote a book on governance, and he's described publicly traded companies as having satisfactory underperformance. Like, Pascal, aren't we playing golf this afternoon at 3? And I'm at the board meeting at till 2, so I'll have to leave the board at 2:15, no matter what's happening, in order to get to the golf course to be with you. So I'm a part-timer, I have a lot of other activities, and I know nothing. I'm gifted, but I'm a gifted amateur. So it's very difficult to get a board to think about, conceptually, about disruption as a threat to their own ongoing corporation unless and until the CEO is willing to share with them his or her concerns, because they just don't know enough about the business. Huh. That being said, in larger corporations with a huge amount of resources, let's say a Canadian bank, one of the chairs of one of the Canadian banks talking about ES&G and what that meant, the board asked the management team, what is this stuff all about and what difference does it make to our bank? And the answer came back, well, we're not sure. So why don't we hire somebody? So the bank had the resources to go out and hire somebody with an ESG label on their forehead. And then 6 months later, after two or three board meetings, the board would ask, well, what has this person discovered? So immediately it's delegated down into the organization. And then within a year, it's probably put down into the operating departments of the bank. So it gets included in the bank's consideration of all of its functioning and business and reported back up. Smaller companies don't have the benefit of that kind of resource to say, I don't know what this DE&I stuff is. I don't know what ES&G is. I don't know what artificial intelligence is. I don't know what machine learning is. And until you get to a size where you can afford to say, well, if we don't understand the impact that machine learning and artificial intelligence is going to have on two of our core businesses, we better find out, you know, hire Bain, hire McKinsey, hire BCG. But if I'd say I'd love to, but I don't happen to have $100 million sitting on the sideline at the moment, then you're in a very difficult spot. So size, I think, matters a lot. The ability of the board to be encouraged to ask questions by the CEO matters a lot. And the expertise of the directors around that table matter a lot. So, long answer, but it's all contextually dependent, I think, Pascal.
You just brought up a whole bunch. I took a bunch of notes here, and you brought up a whole bunch of topics I would love to dig a little deeper into. Let me start with your Anna Karina opening statement, which, by the way, you're the first person who ever brought classic literature into a conversation about disruption. Love it. You made this point, which, in other words, at least it sounds to me, is that the transferability of insight between organizations is somewhat limited. Maybe it doesn't even exist. Which brings me to an interesting point. I happen to write a book about disruption. Now I'm starting to question myself. Are these insights even transferable? You know, can we actually get to an abstraction layer, a useful abstraction layer of insights, which we can give to companies to make the stuff work?
Hey, hard. Anna Karenina, the first line in Tolstoy's great book, I said, very, very, I think, prescient line. Happy families are all happy the same way. Unhappy families are unhappy, each in their own way. Yes, so are there insights that would be conceptually useful for everybody? Yeah, I think understanding my characterization of the separation between the management and the board as having these three features of time. A board typically invests 250 hours a year. A management team's investing 4,000. So what's that? 8%. Mm-hmm. And typically the board understands zero about the business. They join the company board. I mean, I might have been CEO of a major food company, but I'm in the Bank of Montreal board. Like, what do I know about banking? Zero. And then thirdly, I've got a lot of other things going on in my life, whereas hopefully the management team is completely devoted to running the business. I've got two other publicly traded boards. I have my philanthropy. I got my grandkids. I have my teaching. I mean, and. I'm a busy guy. So typically, this notion of satisfactory underperformance creeps in all the time. But I think if you start from the conceptual knowledge of the difference along those three lines between the management team and what they do and the board and what they do, is going to give both sides of the information chasm. Management team knows everything. The board knows nothing. So to feed the board garbage, you're going to get nothing back. And if that's how you want to treat your board as a CEO, presumably that's how it's going to be. But if you follow the McKinsey advice and conceptually say, you know what, as a CEO and the senior management team, our core job with respect to the board is to see if they can help us run this company better. So we've got to be open with them. We have to be transparent with them. I have to have an absolutely intimate relationship with the chair of the board. I'm going to work with that man or woman constantly on trying to improve each board meeting to add value. In my teaching, I never ask the question, or try not to, how did you spend your time as a director at the last meeting? Expenses are gone. I try to say, how did you invest your time? Because if I'm using the word invest, then hopefully you're maybe thinking return on that investment. This is a very hard job to get a return on the investment of a director's time. This is the value added piece, not the policing compliance oversight piece. And then in my boards, I work as the chair probably twice as hard as any other person on the board, because I am trying to build an agenda so that the investment of our time will yield a return to the management team and the company of that investment. And we do annual reviews of the board, but basically I regard each board meeting as an opportunity to make the next board meeting more effective. So I spend a ton of time doing exit interviews, not only with the directors one-on-one. I don't ask them, how did the meeting go, Pascal and colleagues? And everybody says, oh, fine, David, it was great. I'm going to point my finger at you and say, Pascal. And I'm going to look you in the eye and I'm going to say, Pascal, what could we have done to get more of a return from our time in this last meeting? Tell me, speak to me. Would you have too much of this, too much of that? Nothing. And then 2 days after each board meeting, I'll phone you again, because then I'm hoping the silt in the river will have settled to the bottom, the water will be clear, and you'll be able to say, you know, David, if we'd have done this differently, I think we might have got a better return. So as the chair, I really work the agenda as an investment decision, and I like to try to focus that time on one of three lines of sight. So when you think about a board, it has hindsight, that's looking in the rearview mirror, our accounts, our audits, our compliance. Oversight, where are we today? Wait a minute, I thought we were supposed to be in Boston, Pascal. What the heck went wrong? We're in Washington. I mean, is this an operational issue, or does something massive change in our business? And then thirdly is foresight, which I describe simply as where do we want to be when we grow up, and who's going to get us there? So I always try and analyze a board meeting according to those three lines of sight. We did a survey with McKinsey of 275 directors, I guess this was a decade ago, and we asked them, according to these three lines of sight, how did you invest your time generally as a director in your operational duties? And the answer came back sort of 60% of our time was spent in hindsight and oversight, or 70%, and 30% in foresight. So we then asked them the next question, how should you have invested your time? Not how did you, but how should you? And the answer flipped, of course. So we should be investing much more time on worrying about the future, changes to our core businesses, competitive intensity. I mean, the hindsight stuff is all compliance, policing, fine, has to be done. But let's not use our board meeting, our board time, as a time to do that. Think of us as a whole bunch of really gifted experts in various things. How do we get involved in understanding the business and how it might change? So disruption, I think, comes to a board that is mature, and by that I mean has this ability to help the management, has a great chair to manage its investment decisions, and that the chair has a good relationship with the CEO. If the chair and the CEO don't trust each other, the game's over. I actually left a Fortune 500 board because of the divisions between the chair and the CEO. I just said there's no way I can be an effective value-added right. director in this relationship. So, disruption, very complex tools. Yeah, I think there are insights that are useful.
That's good to hear. I'd be curious, you know, one thing which I hear comes through for you over and over again is really this notion around, it starts with the CEO actually being willing to do the work, as in engaging in meaningful way with the board, and clearly also, I think, you know, like doing the right stuff on the company side. As a matter of fact, I believe that, at least for our clients, that there's a German saying which translates really awfully or poorly into English, but the German saying is "der Fisch stinkt vom Kopf," and translates into "the fish rots from the head."
Yep.
It's a very German thing to say. So I'd be curious to understand. So do you think this is something, if you're thinking about the CEO of a company, is it so paramount in your world that you say, if the CEO is not on board in doing these things, then all hope is lost? Or do you believe that organizations, despite a CEO, can be successful?
Yeah, I do. But I do think as a board, though, your sacred task, the one preeminent task above all others, is to select the CEO. And if you get that wrong, for whatever reason, if the person's a psychopath, a narcissistic psychopath, as certain nations have discovered to their discomfort, you're really going to have a catastrophe. Hmm. So I spend a lot of time in the work we do teaching corporate governance, trying to instill in people, A, the sacred nature of that task. Like, everybody is dependent upon you. It's virtually the only task a board does entirely by itself, which is an interesting little feature of it. Mm-hmm. And most boards, while they work at it, I don't think they work nearly hard enough at it. For example, most large corporations, yes, have an HR committee. That HR committee ensures, of course, that there's a training plan for everybody in the bank or the industrial enterprise. So we have candidates inside. But I don't think they're real development paths based upon people's individual strengths and weaknesses and needs that are deep enough. There really should be a very concentrated effort to have a plan for Pascal Finette over the next 5 years to develop fully into a potential CEO candidate. And what does that mean? Well, what do CEOs do? Their job is different from anybody else. So we spend a lot of time on differences of a CEO. And then you ask, well, what are the attributes you would need in order to make that person successful in that part of the business? And does this person have that skill set? The Harvard Business Review work on successful CEOs, I think they do it every 2 years. They take the top 1,200 CEOs and their performance in the world over the last 3 years, and they rank them 80% financial, 20% non-financial. Goodness knows how they do it, but let's assume they do it intelligently. The consequence of that is that 82%, year after year after year, 82% of their selection of the top 100 CEOs are promoted from within. So your odds are substantially enhanced if you are promoting from within. And that means, are you training, really diligently working at these skill sets? And I think that's a job that's very undernourished.
Interesting. I'd love to dig into a question which I find on this podcast has been very controversial, as in very varying degrees of perspective. And this is really the question around, when you look at large corporations, privately held or publicly traded, can they actually even do disruptive innovation as maybe defined by Clayton Christensen? Or are they doomed, for better or worse, to essentially be in the world of sustaining innovation, and then once a disruptive innovation comes along, to hopefully be in a position to acquire or partner or something? Do you have a perspective on that spectrum?
I don't think there's any necessary death that's going to occur, although Google believes that something in north of 60% of today's S&P 500 companies won't be there in 10 years. So Mr. Pinchai has a rather jaundiced view of the survival potential of publicly traded companies at all. I did some work with Stanford and on this question. We asked, what are boards doing today in response? And we took a look at Walmart, who has three directors in their 40s or early 50s. We said, wow, that's because they are regarding themselves as a competitor to Amazon. So that's what they're doing. We then asked how many directors on the S&P 500 are under 40. We couldn't find that because there wasn't a listing, but we could find under 50, and there were 4%. There were 16% above 70. Very interesting. So there's four times as many directors in their 70s as there were in their 50s. That was one thing. So we found that age was not something that boards had responded to, and there may be good reasons for that. Gina Rometty of IBM said, David, sure, I'd love to have some young whiz kid on here, but, you know, I run businesses in 135 different countries. I can't afford to have a pinch hitter on a board for a very narrow subject matter, no matter how important. So maybe that's right. So picking skill sets, you take the retired CEO of IBM rather than the 40-year-old up-and-comer and put her on your board. And you build the skill sets. A more common device, and this is in 92 of the S&P 500s at my last count, 92 of them have got independent sort of incubators. So you acquire talent, you acquire companies, but you keep them completely separate systemically from the operation. And that's, I think, a very powerful way of getting around embedded bureaucracies while not losing your potential to innovate. One board I was on, Colliers, Global Commercial Real Estate, we've bought two companies. They sit next door to the head office of the core company, but they are attached to it in no way except personal people walking in. None of the financial systems, none of the HR systems come from Colliers to the fintech companies. So by having them adjacent to you but not part of you, you hope that you'll be able to pick up on important dramatic changes that do deserve to be migrated into the core company. So that's another device. The fourth one I'll mention is tasking the CEO. This is something a board can do. The Marriott board said to its previous CEO, Arne, we want you to invest 30% of your time in understanding how Airbnb might impact our business because it's taking a lot of share, it's growing, it's got competitors, and we are the largest traditional hotel business in the world, but how's this going to impact us? So Arne turned around to the gentleman who was then running Asia Pacific, Craig Smith. He said to Craig, I want you to invest half your time in understanding what's going on in China in our industry. And Craig said, that's a great idea, Arne, but I've got 3,000 hotels, 500,000 employees. And he said, that's fine, Craig, delegate it. I want you to invest half your time. He ended up doing a joint venture with Alibaba. Alibaba came public on the New York Stock Exchange as the largest IPO ever. I mean, amazing. And it is transforming the business because they're taking insights from Alibaba and the way the Chinese hotel and hospitality industry works, and they're beginning to feed them into Marriott. So independent incubators, I think, are a really highly functional way to go to get around bureaucracies and establish infrastructure.
There's so much interesting stuff I would love to dig into. You made a comment which I literally just wrote this down because it really made my ears prick up. You talked about this idea around the core and the edge and the idea, and you used the Collier example, the idea being that you use the edge to observe what is worth migrating into the core. That I find a really fascinating idea because what I typically hear is much more the John Hagel style school of the core becomes the new edge. Like this idea that this new thing will become so big and like is so radically different that it will just take over what is in the core. And I always thought this, I believe that is exceedingly rare actually, like happening in the real world, beside the fact that it's really hard to do. be curious to hear your thoughts a little bit more on this, like, how do you do that? How do you set this up, this migration, this, like, what is a good way to think about this structurally to do this successfully?
Well, I have one example from IBM in the mid-90s, which you may remember they brought in Lou Gerstner from American Express as the company was going bankrupt. A huge global technology company going bankrupt. They brought in Lou Gerstner, and he brought in as one of 23 vice presidents the CEO of IBM Canada, a man named John Thompson. A year later, John was the only vice president left, and he had become vice chairman. And he spent his entire year traveling around, visiting customers, visiting plants, talking to employees, seeking competitors. And he came back to Lou and he said, Lou, I've traveled more miles, met more people, both in and outside the company, than any executive in the last 20 years of IBM. And I really think I've got a handle on what's happening. And we are perfect, absolutely perfect at one thing. And Gerstner smiles broadly, looking to the answer, and says, that's great, John. What is it? And he says, crushing all new ideas. Now, this is a company that had to radically transform itself from inside. And the one thing the number two person in the company came back with after having traveled the world was we're perfect at crushing all new ideas. That then led to the two of them coming up with a pretty radical solution. And that was that John, as vice chairman of the company, would pick 12 technology projects. He'd be given a budget. I think he was given something like, I don't know, $200-400 million a year. Non-trivial. And he was given the right to choose anybody he wanted to run them, and he could pay them whatever he wanted, and they were not part of any IBM system at all. But they did depend upon his power with Mr. Gerstner. So John set off as an independent incubator. And I think fast forward 5 years, his mission was to create new billion-dollar businesses. I think he created three of them out of the 12 that he'd started with. It was done completely outside the mainstream, but within the structure and the senior management team. And so his advice has always been, you can't take cash flow away from an operating business. If I'm running, let's say, I'm in charge of the hotel business in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and I'm really keen on its potential. I'm going to say to you, Pascal, what do you mean you're taking away half my free cash flow? I got 10 things to invest in for every dollar. Right. And you say, no, David, I'm cutting you back. Every executive will defend almost to the death their right to reinvest every single dollar they earn as a free cash flow. And there's a particularly distressing McKinsey chart that came from a decade ago. It showed reinvestment rates over the last 20 years of companies in the business lines of business they were. 3% was the number. It was absolutely flat over the decades. In other words, people, executives believe they have a profound right to reinvest their own free cash flow in their businesses. I mean, this is the core profitability, Pascal, and you're telling me I can't reinvest in the core business? And you're not going to say to me, well, David, you're going to be irrelevant in 3 years if we don't find a new way of doing it. So the John Thompson IBM making elephants dance way, I think, is probably still the only way you can do it. You've got to get somebody at the top to say, I'm taking 20% of the free cash flow from every operating division. Maybe I'll discriminate between A and B, but basically, and I'm going to give that to my incubator manager, and then incubator manager is going to be my closest, best business colleague, and together we are going to be the instrumentation of change. We're the levers that are going to go back to Pascal and say, actually, Pascal, we're going to sell your business. You're going to be gone. You're the taxi company. We're Uber. You're going to be gone in 2 years. Gone. Not just depressed. Gone. So we're going to sell you now. So it takes the leadership insight at the top, and I think you get the new world vision by farming it out in an incubator to a very senior executive who you trust and know completely.
So it comes back to top leadership, comes back to the fish.
Yeah, very much.
Very much.
Now, boards can encourage that. You know, this is where I could sit down with you as my CEO and say, I'm not sure how artificial intelligence is going to impact us, but let's set up a program where maybe you and I go to somewhere, we listened to Nick Darvogarno, recently retired chief evangelist at Google, and just get some insight from them. Maybe we send some people off within the operating businesses. Maybe we hire somebody inside to give us an insight. Maybe we start an incubator. I think it's really dependent upon the chair to initiate with the CEO the discussion on what are we going to do about this. The answers could range from a little to education to actually starting an incubator.
Interesting. I'd be curious, kind of probably as to wrap this absolutely fascinating conversation up. We talked a lot about boards, and we talked about boards and their role and their abilities to influence innovation and disruption in organizations, mostly from a perspective of large publicly traded company boards, so typically boards which are institutionalized. I'd be curious to hear, if you're thinking about smaller companies, and a lot of the listeners to this podcast, they have, you know, medium-sized companies. They might be, typically might be privately held. So there might not be the legal requirement to actually have a board. Yet I hear a lot, and even startups have advisory boards, for example. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to hear your advice to a CEO or a founder on how do you think about if you, first of all, should you have a board, even if it's an advisory board? And then how do you think about setting it up and then placing the right people so that it is actually effective versus it is just a thing you have on your website?
Good question. My advice to startups is build the board one person at a time. I had one startup, he said to me, I need a board by June because I'm going to go public in September. I said, my advice would be get one director and see if that director helps you and adds value. Then sit down with that one and add another one. So ask yourself, what skills do we need around this table that we don't have that would improve our decision-making, and build it brick by brick. The evidence is very clear that one bad director on a board does more to damage the board than 11 directors that are trying to build a board that works to add value to the company. Make a mistake on that, and you really are in a lot of difficulty. So, number one, build a board slowly. Number two, I would say every CEO, every entrepreneur has to invest some number. Give me the number, 10, 15% in worrying about competitive disruption. And typically that doesn't happen because every CEO entrepreneur has got 156 things to do by lunch. You just sort of have to say, what are the three things I need to get done in the next quarter that give me the best chance to survive? So yeah, I got a whole bunch of stuff to do. I got to get the letterhead. I've got to get a point of sale machine, you know, blah, 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 blah. But what is really going to create the long-term potential for this business to succeed? Because most of the startups don't. And one of those answers is where you're investing your time. Make that very conscious. And I would assert you've got to invest at least 10% of your time in worrying about your competitors, the nature of technology around you, who's leading, and follow the leader.
On that note, as you just said, the 10%, maybe as a last comment on this, we had Bill Passmore on this podcast, who's over at Columbia University, wrote a whole bunch of books, and he gave me this mental framework or numbers, basically, which are, he talks about the 10-10-5 rule, where he says that in his book, the top 10% of your people should spend 10% of their time thinking 5 years out. And it's, you know, it's as good as a rule of thumb, I think, as any. What I find fascinating is when I speak to executives in organizations, and I typically ask them, like, how much time did you spend deliberately actually thinking about the future, say, last week? The response is typically a somewhat shameful zero. So my question is, how much time should we actually invest?
Yeah. Where do you invest your time? It's an investment decision. Unless you're very different from the rest of us, we both have 24 hours.
Fair
question
enough.
Is, how do you invest that time in the next 24 hours? Where is it going?
Right.
At least ensure there is some time being invested in the future. Every week. And maybe you can't do it today because you're with your bankers and then you're with your insurance agent and. But I think every week you should set a target and then ask yourself, if I didn't make that target, why not? Because that's a failure. That is a distinct failure, and it's likely going to impact your business survival rate or potential. And I would then say, what did I learn from that investment last week? And does that indicate that I should be investing more or less? So it's a permeable investment decision that can go up or down. And if you get out there and find, hey, I'm in the lead with this technology, I'm the one penetrating the new markets, then I don't need to worry about that as much. The pace of change, I might be leading it. If I'm number three, maybe I got to invest three times my money, my time, in finding out what the numbers one and two are doing. Don't know. And then I would definitely set up, though, I think to help the discipline, I would definitely set up somebody who I say has seen the movie before. Being with a startup, seeing the incredible amount of detail it has to be gone through, but is able to discern and to help you invest your time in a much more success-oriented way. Because I've seen the movie. Pascal, don't do that today. Today, I want you to go over there and meet with them because. So an advisory board should be a disciplinary force in a startup and a young company, for sure. And the same holds true for family companies. If they're too centrally focused, their vision is going to be hugely truncated unless they have some external advisors. I don't think it has to be a board to move to a fiduciary responsibility, but I think there has to be an intimacy in the relationship that allows you to speak truth to power and to say, Pascal, the way you invested your week last week is going to ensure you're going to fail within the next 12 months. Now listen to me or I'm going to go and do something else.
David, on that note, thank you so much for this conversation. It was great. I loved how we went from talking about innovation disruption to the role of the board to the necessity for leaders to really stand up and do the hard work and be willing to do the hard work and do the hard decisions. And I learned so much. I will eradicate the word spend from my vocabulary, at least when I'm talking about time, and we'll replace it with the word invest. And I think we should all do that.
Yeah. Well, if there's one takeaway, that would be it. Invest your time wisely, prudently, and consistently evaluate that past investment decision so you can get a higher prospect of a return in the future. For the board, the CEO, the relationships, everything.
I absolutely have nothing to add to that. David, okay. Thank you so much. This was a phenomenal conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Pascal.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and leave a quick review. It helps tremendously with getting the insights from our guests out into the world. If you have any questions, send me an email. You can reach me at pascal@finet.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.